This is News in No Time, Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the PTA is looking to gain political power and minimum wage hikes are revisited across the country. Are workers abusing the family leave option? We'll also take a look at that. Joining us from our New York Bureau, Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. At WGBH, Callie Crossley, Social and Cultural Commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston. And proving he's a Renaissance man, Jeff Obafemi Carr, and his new title this week, Founding Artistic Director of the Amun-Ra Theater. He comes to us from Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you all for joining us. Michael Myers, let me go to you first. The one thing we want to talk about is the conversation that listeners just heard in segment A, and that is about the viability of the Civil Rights Commission. You heard two decidedly different thoughts. And I was curious to see you nodding very much in the affirmative with Mary Frances Berry throughout what she was saying.
Absolutely. Mary Frances Berry is the only one in that conversation understood what the U.S. Civil Rights Commission is supposed to be about. It's supposed to monitor civil rights in the nation, race discrimination, sex discrimination, civil rights issues, regard police brutality, voting rights, school desegregation, housing discrimination, employment discrimination. Jerry Reynolds wasn't talking about civil rights. This current group there is rapidly anti-civil rights. They don't want to talk about civil rights. Abigail Thernstrom, who's a member of the commission, and Jerry Reynolds, who's the chair of the commission, they are notoriously anti-civil rights. Abigail does not believe, for example, in school. She's hostile to school desegregation, and particularly busing. Jerry Reynolds is hostile to affirmative action, as is Abigail Thernstrom. They're twins. They're intellectual twins, partners in I think, the crime, to use a word in quotes, that is against civil rights. And I think it has been an inversion of the rhetoric. There has been a reversal of the role of the Civil Rights Commission. And these people ought not be leading the commission. They ought not be on the commission. They ought to resign.
Jeff, let's assume that everything Michael says is true. How disappointed, if at all, should one be if you understand that this is, whether we want to admit it or not, a political tool, quite frankly?
Yeah, it is a political tool. I think we look at organizations that have that have gone through a change over the last several years. We think about in civil rights, the NAACP or the NCCJ, that even went through changing its name. These organizations have morphed with the society that we live in. And what I heard from the representative of the CRC is that there needs to be that kind of anamorphous with the Civil Rights Commission. But what I also heard from Professor Berry was something that I agree with, and that is that we should focus on the core mission of the organization itself. And I think there are organizations that can kind of help both of these things happen. There's a race relations institute here at Fisk University in Nashville, institutes like that that do purely race research and dialogue, but the commission should focus primarily on protecting civil rights. And as long as those issues still exist, then it needs to be focused toward its core mission and not allow itself to be swamped into the politics.
Callie Crossley, can an organization like this be apolitical when it is, quite frankly, political?
I don't think so. But I think what the issue really is that these issues are going to continue to bubble up to the top. And so while you have an organization trying to carry out a political mission, the very social issues that have to be addressed, the ones that Mike ticked off, are going to keep coming up. And they're going to make their way into the court systems. They're going to make their way onto the front pages and into the conversation, into the lives of people, because they are very real and they haven't gone away. I second what Jeff said about race institutes. There's one here at Harvard. There's also one at Northeastern here in Boston. So there are institutes out there doing the kind of research that can demonstrate in a non-subjective way that some of these issues have not gone away. And so the more that they spend time putting political effort into this and not really addressing the issues, then I think we just undermine the society.
Michael Myers, there seems to be the belief that almost 50-odd years ago when this commission was created, almost Pollyanna view, that you could take an unbiased, nonpartisan, politically appointed group of people and make this happen. Has it outgrown its usefulness now in terms of where we are today in that sense?
No. We need a United States Commission on Civil Rights, but we need one that's independent. that's nonpartisan in a disinterested sort of way.
How do you make that happen, though?
Well, you got to have people.
If it's run through the government.
Well, you got to have people on the commission. You got to have a consensus in the country again, which we don't have, about what civil rights are supposed to be about and enforcement of civil rights. We can't have people who are the chair of the commission who don't believe in affirmative action. You can't have the chair of the commission who's hostile to basic civil rights issues, like he was when he was Assistant Secretary in the U.S. Education Department. When you start putting people like that on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, you undermine the very mission and purpose of the commission. So I really believe that this commission is dysfunctional because it's now designed to be dysfunctional, to have a big fight, cultural war, over race issues.
Jeff, let me play devil's advocate. There are going to be some who will take issue with what Mike Myers just said and simply suggest, of course you can have a head of a civil rights commission who's against affirmative action. They will tell you that they don't believe affirmative action is the way to reach equal ground.
But affirmative action is the law of the land.
And
they're supposed to enforce the law.
Simply said, I was playing devil's advocate here, young man. All right,
Jeff, pick up on that. They will say that. They will also be the same kind of people who will try to stick an 8-track tape into a CD player. You really have to look at the times that we live in now, and you have to say that if you're going to be open to dealing with civil rights issues, then every issue has to be on the table for consideration. You can't be closed to one. If so, you're not in a position to be a holistic individual in dealing with everybody's diverse opinions and thoughts and issues, especially when we talk about race and race discrimination, which is one of the hottest issues, as Professor Berry pointed out. You can't be closed to one particular school of thought and be in a position where you're supposed to help everybody.
All right. Let me bring us to an issue that some people are saying they want to become more governmental, if you will, more inside Washington, and that is the venerable organization, the PTA, the Parent Teachers Association, something that those of us who were in trouble at times in elementary school would shudder at the thought that our parents would be a part of that. There is a slow brewing movement of people who are suggesting that they want to turn that group into a strong lobbying organization, much like the AARP, and they point out that the AARP has 35 million members right now. If the PTA were to go, just by sheer numbers, they would have 65 million plus members. What's your thought here, and is it even possible, because PTAs are essentially local groups. There is a national PTA, but for the most part, Jeff, these are local organizations that take issue with things that are going on within their boundaries.
Yeah, I think as a nonpartisan effort, I believe it's only logical for parents to become a part of the political process through advocacy. From our perspective, we have groups like the National Black Child Development Institute that have programs on early learning and parent empowerment, et cetera, that have long been advocates for educational reform, personal responsibility, and support. And I think they could serve as a model for any kind of foray into politics as the national PTA might be considering. Now, with 6 million members and 65 million potential members, the danger is that this group could be swayed to be partisan. And in that case, I think it would be a shame. And just as several groups claim to speak for the moral majority or the downtrodden, I would hate for there to develop a group that swings either so-called right or left, all the while claiming to represent the children.
But, Callie, let's be realistic. If indeed this were to happen, of the 65 million potential members, we know there would be only a handful of people that would truly participate. And one would have to believe, like most lobbying organizations, they would be very political in the way they participated.
You know what? I wouldn't be mad at them, though. I'd like to see some lobbying going on by parents. And I believe that if there were, even with a small number of parents participating, bringing some of these issues that are critical to public education anyway, lack of arts in the school, lack of funding in the schools, are we teaching to the test, these kinds of issues, in as much as that can be brought to bear in a serious way to the folks that are representing us in Congress, you know, I think that's a good thing. Now, the question can they be swayed one way or the other? I got a feeling that some of these problems are so entrenched and are so critical. I think it would be really tough to get parents across the board in some way to sway one way or the other. They just want to get some of these issues resolved.
Here's the reality, Mike Myers. We talked about it being a slow brewing movement. What is essentially happening is that some Republican strategists have seen this, quite frankly, as a way, and they've been on the fore and trying to push this through, as a way to push through some of the issues that they see as teeming with educational issues that they might be able to push the political agenda there. And I'm wondering if that happens, whether Callie would be as excited about that possibility.
A parents' lobby or parents' union, will not work if it becomes partisan. It has to be partisan only in the interest of the children. And therefore, it can't be a PTA. You got to take the T out of the PTA. It has to be a parents' association. It has to be a parents' lobby. And it has to be focused. It can't be scattershot. You can't focus on childhood obesity, school funding, internet safety, everything else. It has to be related to the children and getting the teachers to perform in the schools and assessing the teachers' performance. That's why you need parents. You need parents lobbying, representing their children's interests. And we don't have that, and we need it. And that's not a Democratic Party strategy. It's not a Republican strategy. It ought to be a parental strategy. That's why we need somebody like a George Wiley, who in the 70s created a welfare rights movement. When people hated the notion of welfare rights, he said poor people had rights. And he organized poor people, organized welfare recipients into a lobby of getting their rights and expanded the concept of entitlement.
Yet there is lobbying and there is lobbying. There's a loosely based lobbying, and that is what we see oft times, like these organizations that you just mentioned during that time. And that is a collective group of people who force change by virtue of a collective reasoning and a push from outside. Right. There's the lobbying that Washington knows, Jeff Abafamikar, and that is the kind of whining and dining, whining with an H and without an H, quite frankly, of politicians. And the question here becomes whether or not you can make this a movement, as Michael's suggesting, without it becoming political.
Well, and that's a tough call, because politics, they're on a whole new level nowadays. And when you talk about what lobbyists go through and the things that they do for the politicians in D.C., there, we're talking about a whole new world. And what we have with the 65 million potential members, and we probably would say that, you know, you might be lucky to get 10, 15 million people. But even out of that, to go back to what was said a little bit earlier, it's only a few that usually take the lead in determining where an organization is going to go. And that's where you have the danger of it becoming very political. And I think that eliminating the teachers from the structure of the PTA gives the parents an opportunity to speak for the children, but it also creates a potential danger in pitting the parents against the teachers and holding them to another standard, too. And I don't know how you reconcile that politically.
That's what we need.
I agree.
If I could just add this and say that for sure it'll be political if it's focused on school funding. I mean, we've already discussed on this program how school funding is a political football at this point. So if that is the main focus and there are only a few people leading it, it's going to be partisan. It's going to be political. But if some of these other broader issues, I don't know that it has to be that.
Well, let me say this. If it happens in Washington, D.C., it's going to be political. So there you go. All right. Let us move very quickly with just a little bit of time to talk about the minimum wage. More states are raising the minimum wage and pushing the hourly rate in some states to above $7. And this is also showing the shrinking role of the federal minimum wage, which hasn't gone up in 8 years. There are states, quite frankly, who are saying to the federal government, all right, guys, we're going to force your hand. We're going to show people, frankly, that you're not doing what you should be doing.
Well, let's take some states like New York. I live in New York, and the federal minimum wage does not work in New York. It's very costly to live in New York City. It's very costly to live in San Francisco. So I think it's appropriate that states are saying, recognizing the realities of the cost of living in their own jurisdictions, and saying, okay, the federal minimum wage is just that. It's a federal minimum wage. But with respect to New York and maybe California and other states, we need quote unquote, a living wage, which is different from a minimum wage, which is a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum wage. And I think that's realistic. At the same time, of course, there is the argument, particularly with small businesses and restaurants and things like that, that you pass along the cost of doing business when you raise people's minimum wage in terms of workers, you pass along that cost to the consumer.
Yeah. Go ahead, Callie.
Well, I was just going to say that the problem here is the federal government needs to step up to shore up the economy, and then people could make a living wage. And so we wouldn't be focused on where the minimum wage is state-wise or federal-wise. The states had to step in. People cannot live. I mean, people are working two and three jobs just to try to make ends meet, and they're still not making the ends meet. Something has to give.
And Jeff, yeah. Pick up on your point, but let's also be honest. No matter what we talk about as a minimum wage, when you talk about a family of four, and when you look at what this government, not this government, the Bush government, but our government in general, calculates as poverty in this country, right. You're hard-pressed to do much of anything other than breathe to make it.
You really are. I think about when I was a kid and I was too young for a real job. I worked for this elderly white gentleman in the neighborhood who owned a vacuum cleaner shop. And I'd clean the entire store, dust, fix vacuum cleaners, repair lamps. And I worked every Saturday for 4.5 hours. I got paid $3 and I was happy. 3 years later, when I was old enough for a job, I made minimum wage, right? 3 years later, and I realized that I was 3 years out of a state of totally being pimped. So minimum wage on one level, it protects a worker, and it helps to make an economy stronger. Now, that was over 20 years ago, and the minimum wage has been raised federally less than $2, and that's less than 10 cents a year, which is a shame for the minimum wage. And now minimum wage workers, you know, make me feel... I look at minimum wage workers and I say, man, they're me at 12 in a vacuum cleaner shop. Mm-hmm. So the rest of the country should follow the 17 states that have as they work to enact the minimum wage and to work toward that living wage so they can exceed what the federal government says should be a standard.
But a minimum wage nor a living wage puts you in the middle class. So to get into the middle class, you got to get education and you got to get the skills and the training and the degree to get a high income.
Well, you know, that's a whole nother topic. So Michael Myers, Callie Crossley, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, who I said was a Renaissance man at the beginning of this, and little did I know the boy can fix vacuum cleaners too.
Fix it, man.
Thank you all very much for joining us. Appreciate it.